Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, I Love Lucy, Drag Race, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. This week, we're diving into the Sewers archive to revisit a chat with my friend Fung, who's always tirelessly making stuff. When we chatted 3 years ago, he was busy baking bread, crafting soap, knitting hats, and more. But this summer, he's embarked on his biggest project yet, a new YouTube channel called Rabbit Hole, where he posts videos full of fascinating, weird, surprising features of the planet Earth. Recent topics include animals elected to office, tiny countries you've never heard of, and actual gates to hell. These videos are a continuation of Fung's lifelong habit of making things for others and giving away gifts, because every time he does, there's something equally important that he gets back. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've been posting lots of fun videos about queer pop culture history over on my YouTube. You can also head over to Patreon to see even more bonus videos. And check out my cute little newsletter where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on at mattbaume.com. Also, a big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon and to everybody who's reviewed it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's Fung. Well, this week I'm speaking to Renaissance man Fung. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
These days, I would say for sure Drag Race, because that wasn't a big part of my life before, and it's become such a huge cultural phenomenon.
Is it a phenomenon for you?
It definitely is. I was not engaged at all with this part of the gay culture, and I was actually kind of turned off by it for a long time. I think I was holding on to this idea of masculinity and not feminizing oneself. And I don't know. I feel like it's just internalized homophobia. One of my exes introduced it to me, and it was a long distance relationship. And we spent several nights a week just Skyping with each other and watching Drag Race together. And he'd seen all of it before. So he loved it. And it was something that was important to him. So I watched it because it was important to him, and I wanted that relationship to work. And I found myself just enjoying it immensely.
It sounds like that came as a surprise.
It did. The girls on the show are so talented in as far as making costumes and performing, and their makeup is so fantastic. And since beginning watching that show, I've been to several drag shows, and it's just so much better in person than what you see on TV.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's like an actual give and take, and you're not watching something that's been crafted for you, you know, through the work of multiple producers and editors and music and lights and commercials and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What you said that you were possibly experiencing some internalized homophobia and felt like pressure to reject things that were too feminine. Is that something that you were aware of, or is it just something that kind of unconsciously happened?
No, I feel like I'm 100% aware of what I was doing. Because I grew up in a family of six girls and one other boy. And my brother and I are the youngest of our family.
That's a lot of kids.
I know. And it was very clear that my parents were trying to have a boy, because it's all my sisters in a row, followed by my brother. And everyone is born 2 years apart. So they stopped after my brother. And then 12 years later, there's me, this surprise. It's not a secret that I'm an accident. You know, you look at it and yeah, clearly. So I think there was that kind of pressure for me to be straight, marry a woman, have a family, and carry on the family name.
Oh, sure. I'm a boy, so I've got to, as a member of the patriarchy, it's up to me.
Yeah.
What was it like to grow up with, you said, six older sisters and then one older brother, and they were all so much older than you?
It was weird. I actually grew up with some nieces that are my own age. And they felt more like my siblings or like very close cousins. And that's what we told people when we were growing up, that we were cousins, because it's easier to explain than that my oldest sister is 24 years older than me.
Wow. So yeah, you have a fully grown adult when you were a baby, like as a sibling.
Pretty much. So it was weird. My siblings felt a lot like aunts and uncles as opposed to my siblings. But when I came of age, when I turned probably like 20, 21, and I was drinking and going to college and coming home, I think they saw me finally as kind of an adult and more of an equal.
Sure, because, I mean, your oldest sister would have been like, what, in her 40s at that point?
Yeah.
Was there just a lot of feminine energy in the house, like just girly stuff?
It's a very matriarchal family. we celebrate the women far more than we celebrate the men. Like, we love my dad, we love my brother, and I'm pretty sure they all love me, but it's definitely about the women in the family. Like, my mom runs the house.
In what way? I mean, that must have been an exhausting homemaking experience for her. Like, what did running the house mean? Like, how did you perceive that? Especially when she had, when you were a kid, she would have had, adult daughters.
She made the decisions for the family. She knew what was good for everyone, and she's the one who everyone went to for advice. My dad was much more hands-off in raising his kids. So I don't have a great relationship with my dad, but it's not like we don't talk. We do, but I'm much more my mother's child.
Well, then where did that pressure to not be feminine come from? Like, I know you said, got to carry the family name on, but it seemed like there was so much respect for women in the house growing up. Did that not carry over to respect for men who did not act like men?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. My family is very progressive. We've got a lot of gays in my family. My sister is a lesbian. My uncle who lives with my parents is gay. My nephew's gay. I've got several gay cousins. And my parents are totally cool with it. But as far as their own children go, they would rather that I marry a girl because they still make jokes like, hey, let's go back to Vietnam and find you a wife. Which is, it's awkward because they know that I'm gay. Yeah. They know that I have a boyfriend. They know all of these things about me, but they don't really acknowledge it. So I think that internalizing my own homosexuality was just more to appease them. This is normal, as opposed to going out, being gay, doing gay things.
So when you were a kid, what were the things that you liked when you were a kid, like the TV shows and music and movies and that kind of stuff?
Well, my favorite show growing up was I Love Lucy. And Dick Van, like all of these Nick at Night shows, Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore, Bewitched. And I think I saw a lot of strong women in these shows.
Did you feel like I want to be them or I want to be friends with them?
Kind of both. You know, like growing up and watching strong women and not identifying with a stereotypical male, never playing sports, but the only thing I really did that was kind of heteronormative for a boy was play video games a lot. But I definitely, because I had so many female friends, I much more identified with women in media. Also because girls have these really hot love interests in movies and TV shows, and I'm like, yeah, I could be that. Not the love interest, the girl who's falling for them.
Who were your childhood crushes?
Who were my childhood crushes? Oh, gosh.
You mentioned, Lucy and Mary Tyler Moore. Were you into Ricky Ricardo and Dick Van Dyke? They're not exactly what I consider heartthrobs.
You know what? I did have a crush on Dick Van Dyke.
What was it about Dick Van Dyke that turned your head?
I guess he's a handsome man. He's funny. And it was just one of the few things that I was exposed to as a kid that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you mentioned being kind of more sheltered than you would have wanted to be. So, having Dick Van Dyke there is on Nick at Night. Even in a sheltered childhood, which I had as well. I was very limited in what TV I could watch. Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore in classic TV and, I don't know, Car 54 or whatever, these all feel like very safe things. So I wonder if there was I don't know, some security in the domestic situation of it's just a really stable family. But then I guess you have I Love Lucy, which is not that at all.
Right. I think it was also because my mom and dad liked to watch these shows. So it was something that we could do together.
Did you have other kids your own age who liked the same thing?
No. None of my friends watched these Nick at Night shows. They all watched regular cartoons and Power Rangers and, Saturday morning cartoons. No one watched these old adult shows.
Must have made it a little hard to relate to people when they're talking about Power Rangers and you're like, oh yeah, but did you see the Munsters last night?
Oh no, not at all, because I consumed so much television as a child. I was sheltered more and I didn't go out, with my friends. I didn't, yeah, I was very much just at home all the time. So I had my TV as my best friend. That sounds so sad.
I don't know if it's sad exactly, but, you know, there's something about, like, having TV there as a guide or a teacher to be like, okay, this is what people, this is what the people around you are absorbing, and this is a way to relate to people through the stories. Like, you know, you're not interacting with real people through TV, of course, but you're interacting with real people in your life through the conversations you have about TV, if that makes sense?
Yes.
And you mentioned, like, the strong female characters that you'd see in, like, a lot of shows, and even Power Rangers. I mean, for heaven's sake, it's got, like, Kimberly and Trini and, like, some really, like, strong heroines. I mean, I would consider Rita Repulsa a strong female heroine, but that may seem more about me than about the show.
Yeah, I love that about a lot of movies and TV that I watched as a kid, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for instance, which I feel like every single gay loves. But I watched the original Christy Swanson movie, and I loved it. And I didn't understand everyone's obsession with Luke Perry at the time, even though I did watch 90210 for a while. It was just this sort of, you don't see a strong girl kicking ass like that. And it was kind of someone to look up to.
Yeah, it's a real shame that, like, it's easy to forget that there was even a movie that came before the show. And it's a great movie. Like, it's got Paul Rubens in it. And am I making it up that there's a Sutherland? No, I'm thinking of Lost Boys.
No. Donald?
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Donald Sutherland is her Giles, basically.
Yeah. And also, Ben Affleck is in it.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
He's like some jock in the movie.
Yeah. Well, naturally, of course. So you, like, definitely had, like, a taste in film where you were like, okay, yes, women who kick ass. Did you have, like, something similar in, like, your taste in books and, like, other media?
So here's the thing about books. I work in publishing, and I don't read.
Like, ever? Like, even as...
I love books in theory.
You love the idea of them?
For the most... Yeah, the most common genre of book that I consume is nonfiction.
Well, I mean, that's still reading.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's all sciencey, kind of nerdy things. It's not very often something that, you know, I don't pick up a sci-fi or a fantasy novel. You know, I've never read Harry Potter.
Do you think you need to read Harry Potter in order to be considered a reader?
No, but every year I set myself this resolution of reading 2 books a month, and I make it through January reading like 3/4 of a book. I'm just so bad at it.
I mean, everybody's got their own pace. I mean, it would be silly to be like, okay, my New Year's resolution is to watch like 3 hours of television a week. nobody sets that as a goal for themselves. Or I don't know, maybe somebody does. So like, why not set a goal to like read at the pace that you want to read?
I know this sounds silly, but it's, for me, reading is a little bit unproductive, and I like doing things. So this is why I describe myself as a Renaissance man, and people have used the word rustic to describe me.
Okay.
Because in the past couple of years, I've picked up a lot of hobbies. My best friend is this guy named Eric, and we call him a man of a million hobbies, because every year or two, he'll pick up something new that he wants to do. Like, he's a helicopter pilot, and he took piano lessons and drum lessons, and he brewed his own beer, and he distilled some liquor, and he has all of these weird hobbies. Like, one year he built robots, and we went to a BattleBots competition. But for me, my hobbies are, like, making things. I learned how to make my own bread. I make pasta several times a week from scratch. I learned how to knit this year. So I've been making a lot of items for people.
Knitting is great. When I moved to Seattle from Los Angeles, I was like, oh, it's a cold city. I'm going to knit so much. I really have not. But I every time the weather gets cold, I'm like, now is the time for me to make some mittens for myself. And then it doesn't happen. What do you knit?
So I've made a lot of hats. I've probably made like 5 hats so far this year. Probably my first hat was my third project that I did, which is pretty ambitious. Because I had no idea what I was doing. I just bought a bunch of needles and whatever.
Yeah, hats are hard.
Not really. I mean, they are, but they aren't.
I mean,
And I think I'm just
comparatively,
good at this.
like, I mean, compared
Yeah.
to a scarf, let's say.
Yeah, a scarf was probably like my fifth project, which is totally the reverse of what everyone else would be doing.
Yes. Yeah, scarf's where
I
you
jumped
start.
right into it. I started designing my own patterns really early. I made a Louise Belcher hat from Bob's Burgers.
With like the pink ears.
Yeah, and it was a pattern that I just came up with myself. And it looks
That's
really good.
impressive. That takes a lot of like, I mean, there's a lot of math and geometry that you got to be able to do.
I think I'm just one of those people who can envision what I want out of something. And knitting is so technical, but it's easy. I feel like it's witchcraft, though. It's,
How is it witchcraft?
you're making this really nice item out of two needles and yarn. Like, how does that work?
It is, I think there is something gratifying about like looking down at what's in your hands and being like, oh, it's an actual thing that I can put on my body. It's not like just this like long tangle of yarn somehow.
Yeah, I like before knitting, before learning how to knit, I just imagined it was like, how do two sticks and a piece of yarn turn into a sock or a sweater? I don't understand this. And even now, like I look down at my fingers, I'm like, what are you doing?
Right, you're like casting on, casting on, casting on. You're like, wait, how do I just know how to do that? Like your hands just kind of
And
like take over.
like a week later, I have a damn sock in my hand. Where did this come from?
I'm so impressed by that because like it's one thing to just to be able to do all the counting and get the rows and everything right and like actually have a functional piece of clothing, but then to actually do it in a way that it fits, like that's where the math happens and you're like, okay, I've got this many rows, this gauge, and this kind of yarn. Like, you have to think about a lot when you're doing that.
I made my first sweater a couple months ago, and that was the most technical thing I'd done. And it was hard,
Yeah, I've
but
never attempted a sweater.
so you know, have you heard of the boyfriend sweater? Not the boyfriend. Have you heard of the sweater curse?
No.
The sweater curse is if you start knitting a sweater for your significant other, they will break up with you before you finish it.
Oh, gosh, that's dark.
Right? It's kind of grim. But when I knit my sweater, okay, so backtrack a little. My ex-boyfriend, the one who I was in that long distance relationship with, he told me that he was knitting me a sweater, and he told me probably like 4 or 5 months before our relationship ended. And that got me thinking, like, oh man, a sweater is really hard to do. Like maybe they take years sometimes, and that's why that there's that long window for someone to break up in that relationship. And then I knit my own sweater, and it took me like a month and a half. I'm like, are people just really bad at knitting?
I think you might just be really good at it.
I also don't have a lot going on in my life. Like,
Well,
I've
I
got a
guess that helps.
boyfriend. Like, my boyfriend and I, what we do is we'll sit on the couch, eat dinner, and then drink wine and watch TV, like a simple documentary. He passes out at 9, 10 o'clock. And I stay up another 2 hours just knitting.
Like when you're doing that, does it like either knitting or making pasta or baking bread or whatever, does it feel like you're actually doing magic to make something just spring to life?
Sometimes I have people over for dinner sometimes, and I can whip up a really fantastic meal in about half an hour, and everyone is just really amazed. And I'm like, it's Tuesday. It's not a special day, but this is how I cook.
Did you always have like dinner from scratch when you were growing up?
Well, my mom was the one who cooked, and people are like, oh, yeah, you must have learned from her. I'm like, no, absolutely not. I've tried a few times to learn from my mom how to cook, but she'll show me what she's doing. And she's like, well, here's about a cup of this. Oh, it doesn't taste right. And then she'll throw in a handful. I'm like, how much is a handful? Like, it's so hard to learn from my mom. But I think, because television was my best friend growing up, I watched a lot of cooking shows. That was when Food Network was coming up in its own, and I just devoured all of those cooking shows.
Somebody once told me that when you are learning from a relative, particularly an elderly relative, how to cook, that every unit of measurement is a gram because it's what a grandmother would use.
Oh,
So, and
love that.
yeah, like everything, it's just here, just use a gram, and that could be a handful or it could be a pinch or whatever.
I'm going to tell all my friends that one.
So you like to just whip stuff up and make stuff. I mean, it makes sense to me that you'd be interested in Drag Race because that's so much what Drag Race is about. Like, you've got 2 hours, you got to make an entire like runway look.
It's so amazing what they can do in just like a day. And I'm always very impressed with their ideas. Some of those girls are so talented. But then again, like some of those girls, having watched like 5, 6, 7 seasons of Drag Race, they come into the show and they're like, I don't know how to sew. I'm like, you're getting kicked off third. You can't come into this competition and not know how to sew clothing. You can't rely on super glue.
How do you decide what kind of making you want to learn how to do next?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I feel like I jump interests a lot. So did I already say that I make soap?
You did not. Okay. How do you make soap? Is it like Fight Club?
Yeah, pretty much. You melt down some fats and you add a chemical to it. In my case, I use sodium hydroxide, otherwise known as lye, which is what they used in Fight Club. And you mix that together and let it pour it into a mold and let it sit for a day. And then it has to dry out before it's usable. But the reason why I started making soap was I was watching the first season of Orange is the New Black. And I realized I was spending so much time just marathoning television that I felt like I needed to do something productive. And the main character in Orange is the New Black, Piper, whatever, before she goes to prison, she was making soap. And I looked at that and I was like, wow, that looks easy. And maybe my house will smell nice. So I was like, all right, I'm going to start making soap. And I'm just so easily influenced by things that I watch. Uh-huh. And I'm like, yeah, I can do that. I'm going to make soap. I'm going to buy the ingredients and just do it. And I did. And it's fantastic. Like, I almost exclusively use my own soap at home. I give it away as gifts. My work has an annual craft fair. So every year I'll make a ton of soap and sell it there. And I make a few $100. I'm like, this is a sweet gig.
Have you ever thought about selling stuff more like regularly, like on Etsy or something?
Yes, I have an Etsy store, but it is not populated with anything. I'm ready to start my own store. I just need to get off my ass and actually do it.
What would you sell? Like of all the stuff that you make, like it's hard to imagine, like this is the store that has socks and soap and bread.
Well, I wouldn't sell anything perishable.
I can see the danger there, but like soap is easy and socks, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. All of this stuff that I normally make is relatively easy, but I would absolutely sell soap. Soap and like scrubs, lotions, all of those pretty bathroom things. I made bath bombs also 1 year, and those are super easy. You go to a fancy store that sells soap, and the soap is like $6, $8 a bar. And when you consider the cost of ingredients, each bar of soap is like 50 cents. It's, what is that? A 1,000% markup?
Where do you, like, I guess you're paying to, for the privilege of not having to deal with lye and to, like, not have to have, like, actual dangerous chemicals, right? Like, it is hazardous to make soap.
I guess so, but at the same time, it's like, this is such an easy thing. Anyone could do it. Like, all you really need are some rubber gloves and a well-ventilated area. And you're fine. Like, I do this in my kitchen.
So do you, like, just looking around where you live, like, how much of the stuff that you interact with at home, like, how much of your house where you are, like, it's, you know, your place of safety and your refuge and the place where you go to just be you and by yourself, how much of that is stuff that you feel you should be making?
Oh, gosh. At this point, I make so many things. I have this wardrobe where my underwear and sock area is a mess. And so I went to Walmart with my boyfriend after camping, and there was this really nice felt basket there, but this basket didn't have any tags on it whatsoever. Like, it had no label on it. It had no barcode on it. And there was only one of these baskets there. So I decided to buy it and then search on the internet for the same thing so I could buy a second one. I could not find one at all. And so I went home and I was like, well, if I can't find a basket that I like, I'm going to make one. And so I knit a damn basket for my underwear to live in.
Oh, so you learned basket weaving just so that you had a place to put your underwear.
Is that silly?
Well, I don't. It's not something I've heard of anyone else doing, but if you need a place, what else are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, when you can't find the thing that you want and you know how to do it, then why not just do it?
So you said, like, this is one of the reasons that you don't read a lot is because, like, it consumes so much of your mental energy and you want to be spending that on constructing things, right?
Yeah. I love making things with my hands.
Do you not feel like when you're reading or watching TV or watching a movie or whatever that, like, I don't know, you don't feel like you're making an experience? I guess it's not a physical thing.
Well, when I watch TV and movies at home, I'm almost always knitting or I'm doing something with my hands. I'm keeping busy. Like, I can't, unless I'm super stoned and I can't do anything, I'm usually just knitting.
Do you get, like, super antsy when you go to a movie theater or a concert and, like, you would be knitting, but you can't because you're out in public?
A little bit, because usually when I'm out, I think about what I want to be knitting.
I'm familiar with that experience.
I have such a bad addiction. I have so much yarn that I bought for a bunch of different projects that I'm planning on making this year. And I had to put a moratorium on buying more yarn and more knitting supplies. I have probably like 8 projects in the pipeline right now.
And what are your projects?
I'm constantly, I'm making a pair of socks for my niece. I'm going to make a hat for my mom for Christmas. I am going to make a cardigan for myself. I'll probably make myself some socks because these socks that I'm making right now are super cute. And they're also the first socks that I've made. One of my friends commissioned 3 Louise Belcher hats for his nieces, so I have to do that. I'm making a sweater for a friend and like 3 more hats that people want. So I've got a lot of things going on.
You mentioned that this was kind of a new thing, that you only recently started to pick up a lot of hobbies in the last few years.
Yeah. I started knitting in February. I probably started making pasta 2 years ago, made soap. I started making soap whenever the first season of Orange is the New Black premiered, so like 4 years ago, I think.
Okay.
Maybe 5 years. I don't know where this all sprouted from. I think it's because I have my own space now, whereas before I was sharing a very small apartment with someone. Mm. And so now I live in a nice 2-bedroom apartment, have a great roommate, and I just have all of my crafting things all around the place.
How does the roommate feel about all the crafting that's happening in that space?
Question mark.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, if somebody was doing, like, a lot of, like, soap making in the kitchen, I'd be like, okay.
Yeah, I do take up a lot of space with my stuff. I do feel bad about it. But at the same time, like, it doesn't stick around for long. I'm giving away most of it.
So we know each other from, like, years ago when I lived in San Francisco, and you certainly were not, like, this intense about making stuff back then when we lived in the same city. So I'm just, like, curious what happened, like, after I left, basically, that, I mean, you said it was, like, you got your own space, which, yes, that is good, but, like, were you, like, during that time, were you just like, oh, man, I really wish I had enough space to make things? Or did you just, like, become aware that you really enjoyed making things?
Do you think this is, like, a quarter? No, I'm not even. No. Do you think this is, like, a third life crisis?
Well, I don't know if it's a crisis.
Like, oh, I've been so unproductive my entire life. I got to do something. I've got to make a name for myself and make everything in my life.
I don't know. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like you haven't made anything?
A little bit. I feel like I didn't do a whole lot with my life, and I've been so lazy, and now I'm just doing everything. Have you ever gotten this?
I think we have similar impulses, because I also feel a lot of pressure, self-imposed, to constantly be making. For me, it's not like physical stuff so much as just content. And so this is why I have this podcast and another podcast, and I'm constantly writing for different outlets, and I'm taking pictures of everything. And so, like, I definitely know the feeling of, like, I just need to make. I can't be sitting here. I always, like, what am I working on next?
Yeah. And then when you're not working on something, you're thinking about what you want to work on.
The stuff that you're making, are you making it for you or are you making it for other people?
Both. Like, a lot of the things that I knit, I don't even accept money. I'm just like, if you want something, tell me. If you're around, you can buy the yarn with me, but I'm just going to give it to you. If it's food, if it's pasta or bread, I'll make it. And if I've made extra pasta, I'll just bring it to work and give it to one of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
If I make soap, like, I'll give it to my friends and family, and I'll sell out at work. But I do this because it's something I enjoy. I like making things with my hands, as opposed to, like, I'm doing this because it's another source of income.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, I can't imagine you're making, like, a killing on just, like, the home-based kitchen soap endeavor. So it's not like, at last, the soap will make me rich. But, I mean, there's other ways to be rich, I suppose. Like, what does it feel like? Are you getting, like, a lot of gratification? Do you feel really gratified when you hand that thing that has a little bit of you, that that gift that you made, to another person?
I absolutely do. I feel like I don't take compliments very well. And so when I give someone some pasta and they come back and they say that they loved it, or that whatever socks and hat that I gave someone, and they're like, this is the best thing ever. No one has ever made something like this for me. I feel very happy. I always have to ask and make sure, you know, are you lying to me? Is that pasta actually good? Or are you just saying that to be nice? Like, I can't take compliments, and I don't know why, but it's maybe it's giving me a sense of fulfillment.
Did you not feel fulfilled before you started doing more making?
Oh.
Was it something you were aware of? Like, were you like, there's something missing?
I think so. I think, you know, sitting around all day, not doing anything, not being productive, was kind of wearing on me. And so I try to be active. I try to, you know, I make a lot of things. I go to the gym a lot. I make a lot of time for my friends now. Whereas I think before I was very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? I think I was very comforted by the idea of just staying home and being cozy.
I mean, cozy is a good thing. It's nice to feel nice.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm going to do tonight.
Good. I mean, I guess, like, cozy is an enviable place to be, especially if you have, like, a lot of creative nervous energy, because it's hard to feel comfortable if you're always feeling like, oh, but I'm not doing enough.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as we get off the phone, I'm going to get really high, watch a movie, and knit these socks. And just, you know, be cozy at home, but also be productive at the same time.
Oh, that's the perfect mix. Like, to be comfortable and productive at the same time. Like, that is the that is the elusive life goal that I'm constantly pursuing.
It's a nice combination.
When did you know? When did you figure out, like, okay, this is the thing for me. Like, making stuff is what makes me happy.
The same way I grew up watching Food Network and watching This Old House and all of these people making things, I felt like I could do that. And I never had the opportunity to. Like, I don't think I started cooking for myself until after college, when I lived in an apartment with a kitchen that I had free rein to use whatever. Do you remember staying at my apartment a few years ago, because you were in town for a convention? I can't remember which one.
I think
you slept on my couch.
Some gay marriage thing.
Oh, maybe.
Gosh, I can't remember what it was. Must have been very important.
Yeah, but you stayed on my couch, which is like a small couch, and I do fall asleep on it sometimes. But, like, having slept on that couch, I'm like, I can't believe that Matthew slept here. It's so uncomfortable. And so that winter, I built a storage ottoman that is the same height as the couch and the exact width of the couch. So it extends further. So it's like much more comfortable to sleep on now.
Oh, wow. Wait, you made an ottoman?
Yeah. Like, I went out and bought wood and I upholstered it.
Well, okay. I mean, like, everything that you tell me that you're making, I'm like, okay, that is something that you have to, like, dedicate yourself full time to learning how to make that. But I guess I'm wrong about that.
It took me a few days, and it was a design that I came up with myself, and it works. So I'm quite happy with it. And people come over for D&D sometimes, and we'll just use the storage ottoman as a really long bench.
Huh. Well, there you go. I'm glad that you've got, like, it's pretty impressive that you've got, like, that impulse to be like, okay, I need a thing. What are the pieces of the thing? How do the pieces fit together? Now I have the thing.
And sometimes it surprises me that other people can't do this. And I'm not saying it in an arrogant way. I just feel like it's so easy and so natural for me that it's surprising that other people don't feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. I'm still searching for, like, that moment when you knew, like, that you were a maker. Maybe there wasn't a moment that you just started, I don't know, getting off of the, I'm just sitting on the couch to, I'm actually doing something with my hands. Like, when did you, was there a point where you said, I want to keep doing this?
I don't think so, but I do realize that my family, the immediate family that I grew up with, everyone made things. Like, my mom was a fantastic cook, and she made clothing. She had a giant sewing machine, and so she would make bed linens and clothing for people. And my dad was a mechanic, and he was, like, really great at wood shop. My sister baked and decorated cakes. A lot of my family made things. I feel like I come from a very creative space, but I never fully expressed myself until adulthood.
Isn't it funny how, despite all our best efforts, we become our parents so completely?
Yes. Oh, I tried so hard as a kid not to turn into my dad, and I didn't realize I turned into my mom.
Yeah, it's difficult not to. Like, there are moments when James points out to me that I've said something in exactly the same way that my mother would say something, or I've judged somebody in exactly the same way that she would. And these things are just sort of baked into us. Do you feel like this is something you have in common with your parents that you could talk to them about? Like the wood shopping and the making and the cooking?
Yeah, I talked to my mom about it, and I sent her pictures, and I showed her the sweater that I made. And the first thing that she said was, "You're always knitting like a girl." I was like, I don't know how to respond to this, but thank you.
I'm sure that didn't interact with your that internalized homophobia that you were talking about in any way at all.
Right? When I try to express myself in any way, my mom is just kind of like a little downer there. Hmm. The first time I made egg rolls, and I was very proud of it. Mm-hmm. First time I made egg rolls, and I showed her a picture, she said, "Those look burned."
Well, thank you for the feedback, I guess.
She is the authority on that.
What's next on the agenda for you? Like, what do you want to learn how to make next?
I don't know if I want to learn anything new at the moment. I'm very happy with knitting, but then I say that about almost everything that I do. I thought I was happy with making soap and bath products, and obviously I moved on to something new. I'm thinking, though, that I could combine some of these crafts, and I could make one of those, like, felted soap balls that you've seen. I don't know if you've seen, but I've seen them.
Oh, felted soap balls?
It's a bar of soap that's wrapped up in yarn, and the yarn is rubbed so much that it felts itself. And so you use this as a shower scrub or a bath scrub instead of a sponge or a loofah or whatever it is.
Okay, so it's like I was about to say, like, is it just something that you dissolve and you have, like, little fragments of yarn in the tub? That would be terrible. But I see. It's like it's a thing you scrub yourself with.
Yeah.
Well, that's cute. These are very, like, comforting, homey things that you tend to make. It's not like you're going out and making, wilderness survival gear. You're making stuff that will make someone feel like either swaddled in a comfy hat or scrubbed clean or something like that. So I don't know. These feel like somehow very, everything that you make seems very relaxing.
Oh, that's a nice way of saying that. I haven't heard that from anyone yet. Most people are like, wow, that's a really great handy hobby. And then I forget who it was, but one of my friends told me that it makes me sound very rustic. And I loved that word because it It implies that one day I could live off the grid in some cabin somewhere, growing my own wheat, raising a sheep so I could shear it and make wool. Ooh, maybe that could be my next project.
Oh.
Spinning my own yarn. Yes, I'll live in the wilderness of the Pacific Northwest in my cabin by the ocean, wearing my cozy homemade sweater with my own wool, baking my own bread from wheat that I grew. God, this sounds like such a great life.
Yeah, honestly, that sounds like idyllic. Let's start making plans. Let's make that the goal.
I'm into this.
Me too. Okay, I'm glad this is the last episode of Sewers of Paris. We're going off the grid now.
Sorry, guys. I
Well,
took him away from you.
but I love that, like I said, like it all seems so comforting. It sounds like it's comforting for you to make. So you're, making yourself feel cozy by making things that make other people feel cozy.
Yeah. I also have this little seed in my head that's like, one day the world is going to end. So, in my own way, I'm a doomsday prepper, but I'm just not prepping, I'm just learning skills.
That is, yeah, in the back of my mind, I've got that as well, where I'm like, oh, I should probably learn how to like purify water just in case. And like, maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing to learn how to like slaughter chickens in case it comes to that. I don't know how close we are. I feel like the second hand on the doomsday clock keeps like vibrating back and forth. So I don't know. At the very least, we can knit.
Did you ever watch the show? It was on TLC or maybe Discovery Channel called Doomsday Preppers.
No.
It was so fascinating. Every episode would focus on two or three different families for like 20-minute segments. And each one of them had their own idea of how the world was going to end and how soon that was going to happen. And so you got people who were living on ranches by themselves or like secluding themselves in old missile silos, just hoarding a bunch of stuff, going to the store, buying a bunch of stuff, buying a bunch of guns, buying a bunch of liquor. And they would say things like, well, you got to defend yourself. I'm not going to drink all of this, but I can use it to barter. And, doing all of these really weird things, like going through doomsday scenarios, getting their go bags together. And then at the very end of the show, or the end of each person's segment, the narrator would say how likely the scenario would actually happen, like a volcano erupting or martial law happening. And it would be like a 0.005% chance of this happening within the next 30 years. And all of these people are prepping for absolutely no reason. But.
But no one can see the future, and it's just nice to be, honestly, with all the doomsday stuff, I do feel like a little bit of that is like the paranoia or just like anxiety of like things feel very impermanent, and it's good to feel secure, like you can take care of yourself, and have some control over forces at a time in the world when it feels like you have very little control. So maybe that's what all this like making of stuff comes down to. Like I make dinner from scratch just about every night. I make a lot of stuff for the internet, but mostly from scratch. And I participate in construction of things. Like I do shows and video projects and all that kind of stuff. And I wonder how much of like that impulse is just there's so much happening that makes me worry. And makes me feel like I have no control over it. But carving up a chicken or roasting some asparagus, that I can do. I can make sure that these spring rolls don't get burned the next time I make them.
I think it's a really wonderful skill to have. And I think that's kind of what I do all around me. Just pick up these really nice skills to have just in case. Just in case the world does end, my sweater's not going to last 20 years. I should learn how to make more sweaters.
There'll always be,
Yeah.
here's what it is, you'll always have that thing. You can always generate comfort for yourself.
Yeah. I would like to do one of those nature walks where someone points out what's edible and what's not. There was some guy in LA who did that. I think he still does it, though.
Ooh,
And
I'd
he
be
walks
nervous about
around.
Los Angeles, eating any flora from Los Angeles.
Right? You go on this nature walk with this guy, and it's probably like a 3-hour hike. And he points out all of these things and he harvests them as they're doing their nature walk. And at the very end of the whole ordeal, he makes a salad for everyone.
Oh.
And I'm like, that sounds nice, but also I don't know if I want to eat anything that's been sitting out in Los Angeles, because that place is, sorry, LA, but that place is polluted as hell.
Yeah, you know, I went on a walk in San Francisco where it was, this is going to sound riveting, it was a hydrology walk where we went to places that were doing interesting things with water, because that's the particular brand of neurodiversity that I experience. And so one of the places that we visited was a house where people were filtering their laundry water through a garden to irrigate. And so they were using all what they said were food-safe compounds to launder their clothing, and then the washing machine like filtered out through this filtration system through the garden where they made all this edible, they were growing all this edible stuff. And I was like, I respect your commitment to the water cycle here, but oh, I just don't know that I would want to eat the like tomatoes that grew out of the water that cleaned my underwear.
Yes, this is how I feel when I learned that astronauts drink recycled pee.
Mm.
It's like, yes, I know that it's been filtered and cleaned, but I'm not into drinking my own pee. I don't know how this works.
I'm just imagining you up on the space station knitting away in zero gravity, being like, no, that's okay. I'm not thirsty.
Just up there for 2 weeks.
Yep.
Drying out, dehydrating myself.
Yep. Doing some knitting, making sure you get some, like you brought some soap up into space.
At least I'll be clean and cozy. I just won't be very hydrated.
Honestly, clean and cozy, that sounds like a great memoir for you to write about all the different crafts that you've learned to master.
Oh, I have wanted to write a nice little book about some craft. Like, I really wanted to do a cooking book. They're called cookbooks. Oh, Lord. No, I wanted to write a cookbook for someone like myself.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who already knows how to cook. And so it's not really like a book of recipes. It's more of a book of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really need a recipe, here's one provided. Yeah, it's like this main dish, you know, how to roast a chicken, how to cook potatoes in certain ways, or what kind of potatoes are good for mashing or frying, and how to combine these things into a meal that complements itself.
Perfect. Well, get on it. I mean, this is your next thing to master. I mean, you're already in publishing, so don't let anything stand in your way.
I do miss writing, though. I don't have great writing ideas anymore.
You just had one.
Well, okay.
All right. Well, we're going to be looking forward for your Fung's Guide to Life. how to cook, how to make stuff, how to feel clean and cozy, and everything you need to know to survive the apocalypse.
Oh, yes. Okay. I'm going to have to write that down because that's going to be the title of my book.
Great. Fung, thanks again so much for joining me.
Oh, this has been great.
Big thanks to Fung for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards, including a fun care pack in the mail. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.